Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could join us today. During this hour of the program, a medical topic, we'll be talking about asthma, what it is, what to do about it, some of the issues that pertain to all of us, really, as people who may perhaps be affected by directly or through the people that we care for who might have experienced asthma. Our guest is Shauna Johnston. She is a medical doctor. She's a director of the asthma clinic at the University of Illinois McKinley Health Center. And she has a great deal of experience dealing with asthma as a physician and researcher, and we will talk with her during this hour. As we do so, your questions are welcome. That's what this show is all about. We can't obviously diagnose people over the telephone, but we'll try to provide some good general information and answer any questions that you have on the topic. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, and toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Johnston, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks for being here.
It's nice to be here.
Well, let me just start by observing that it seems kind of alarming to see that asthma has grown in incidence so rapidly over the past couple of decades.
Yes, and especially even in the last 3 years. According to the National Heart, Blood, and Lung Institute, program in 1979 where they came up with new guidelines for diagnosis and treatment, there was about a 6.5 to 7% incidence of asthma in the general population. And now, just a few years later, that's almost 10%.
That's that's amazing. And some of the some of the research I found on the web, there's obviously lots of good stuff there. The prevalence of asthma increased 75% between 1980 and 1994.
Yes.
So then, we're adding to that. What is, is there any kind of understanding or theory as to why that might be the case?
Well, the best catch-all answer on that is it's multifactorial. Yeah, there are a lot of things being thought about. There are a lot of things that are contributing to it. We think for sure that pollution in our environment has a lot to do with it. We know that the bad things that are affecting the ozone layer are allowing not only more pollutants, ozone, which is not good for the respiratory tract. It's also having holes in the ozone layer is causing ragweed, for instance, to increase its pollination by 4 to 10% this year. So pollen and other inhalants are a factor. We think that decreased physical activity, a more sedentary lifestyle, and obesity are contributing factors. I think one of the most fascinating theories being promulgated is something called the hygiene hypothesis. And a study was done in New England this past year, which discovered that infants given antibiotics within the first year of life had a tenfold increased risk of asthma later in life. Also, when we think about it, our ability to diagnose has improved, but the incidence is also increasing. So both are a factor. I'm in my 50s, so when my parents were growing up and in the early part of this century, we had real diseases. I really had measles. I really had mumps and whooping cough. And my parents had these real diseases. There were very few immunizations. And we had some antibiotics, but maybe half a dozen. Mm-hmm. And we had general soap and detergent, but today we've got hundreds of soaps and detergents. Our children are being immunized against almost every possible medical contingency of infectious disease. We are using deodorant this and antibacterial that. And as many of our listeners and you already know, there's a great deal of concern in the medical community, and patients at large are understanding more now about the tremendous overuse of antibiotics when they are not indicated. And what all this seems to mean is that our immune systems back earlier in this century had real things to fight. they had real things to do. Now, with all these things we've just mentioned, there's really nothing outside the body for the immune system to fight. There's nothing real for it to fight, so it turns on itself and tends to make the body hyper-responsive to other things that normally hadn't caused problems.
That's a really interesting hypothesis. I want to ask you some more about that. I'm hesitant to make this caller wait too much longer. We do have somebody waiting. So why don't we include them in our conversation, and we'll, if they don't pick up on that thread, we'll make sure that we do as well as we talk.
Sure.
Okay, let's talk with a listener in Aurora on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you. This is a very timely subject, and I thank you for it. I have a granddaughter that coughs much.
Yes.
And she was taken to the doctor last Thursday and given an antibiotic. She is out of school frequently with coughs and cold-like symptoms. She didn't run a temp.
Yes.
But she's on amoxicillin.
Yes.
And I say what you're saying. Their world seems to be, maybe you can term it more accurately than I am, but they have so many things around them. They have stuffed toys, multiple stuffed toys. They have VDs. They have so many plastics. They go from the TV set to the computer. I mean, their world is, you know, they're not like outside with the fresh air and sunshine. They're like captive to this plastic corporate world.
Yes. Well, I think one of the things, if your granddaughter is having this many respiratory problems, perhaps her parents ought to address with her doc some concerns.
Oh, we have.
Have you? We know that asthma, you can have a genetic predisposition.
Oh, yes.
We know that viral respiratory tract infections are the hugest culprit in actually causing asthma and asthma flares.
They told us she had a viral infection last week.
Yes.
Last spring. Now, how does that determined?
Well, probably over 90% of sore throats and respiratory tract infections that we get are viral. In fact,
how
one of them.
How is that determined?
How is that determined? Because of its prevalence. Usually, if there's a bacterial infection, there is a high fever, often very darkly colored mucus secretions, although color does not necessarily correlate with bacterial infection. Usually, the person is systemically sick all over.
Systemic.
Rather than having, say, a stuffy head, bad cough, headache, just feel nasty. Generally, people with a bacterial infection tend to be a lot sicker.
Oh, yes, you know, and that's exactly what she is. She didn't have a temp last week. I had a mother take it 3 times. There was no elevated temp.
Well,
like you were saying.
That's a general tool. It's not categorically, but usually bacterial infection. A person runs a significant fever because it's something where the poisons, the toxins from the bacteria reset the body's own thermostat in the brain, and it has a much wider range. Viruses tend to affect individual cells. They hit up the cells that line the respiratory tract from the nose down to your lungs. And one of the most interesting things about asthma and adenovirus is that there is now known there is a direct effect. There is something called interadhesion cellular substance, and this is a chemical substance that binds the surface epithelial cells to each other, and that the virus itself has a direct effect on loosening this bond between cells, which is why certain common asthma drugs are not always helpful for asthma flares from a cold from an adenovirus.
The other thing, I see these strong things they use for wash day.
Yes.
These liquids.
Yes.
And they really get the clothes white, but I wondered what else they were doing.
Well, there's perfumes, of course, which are an inhalant. I think one of the things that has always concerned me was the enzymes that are present. Also, being outdoors is a good thing to a certain extent, but very, very important, especially in more of a metropolitan area, but very important is, as I mentioned, we're heading into ragweed season now, going to be the last week of July. It's going to be a really awful one, probably about the worst in 10 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Also, when you're in a more urban setting, you've really got to worry about pollution, automobiles, industry. And so I'd really advise anybody with respiratory problems to please pay attention to air quality alerts on your news media. And if the air quality is not good, you don't want to be outside.
Well, so when is it determined that you have asthma? How many symptoms do you have to have to know that it is asthma?
Kind of depends on your index of suspicion. One thing that happens is anyone, whether they have a genetic predisposition for asthma or atopic allergies, anyone who develops a respiratory tract infection, and especially a viral one, can develop asthma-like symptoms. These symptoms can persist for weeks to several months after the acute episode has resolved. When you worry about asthma is if the symptoms persist beyond that perhaps 3-month period, or if a person is continually having respiratory symptoms without a reasonable explanation. And often, even if we have someone that has asthma-like symptoms from an acute viral respiratory infection, we treat them exactly like we would with somebody with asthma, and we follow them, sometimes try and taper them off their medicines. If they do wonderfully well, then we know that this was just an acute thing. And if we try and taper them off their medicines and they get more and more symptoms, then we tell them that they have asthma. I think it's important to give somebody a diagnosis because that way you can begin to compartmentalize it, understand it, and deal with it. And I guess where I'm coming from is I really think it's critical in dealing with asthma to, number one, be partners with your clinician. And also, it's been demonstrated over many, many years that the more aggressive that you are with diagnosis and management, the more education that is included so that everybody's on the same page, the better control and the less symptoms, the less it has to interfere with a person's life.
Is there anything in the blood, any level of something that tells you that person has asthma?
No, but there is an immunoglobulin E, which is associated with the condition of being atopic, or which is the medical term for being allergy prone.
And what did you call that? What E?
IgE.
IgE. And it's...
There tends to be more of it circulating in the blood in people who have allergies and asthma, and often allergies and asthma, hay fever, chronic postnasal drip, and asthma often go hand in hand.
And one last question. What animals, she has a house full of animals, what animals are the most likely to cause a problem?
This is really dependent on the person as an individual. Cats and dogs a lot. I think I can, but cats and dogs, companion animals, are critical for someone's mental health and well-being. So
that's the problem.
I don't hold with, mm-hmm. I mean, I think allergists are important, and if you have severely compromised respiratory tract, you may not be able to have a companion, a warm-blooded companion animal. Birds are also a problem. The critical environment to control is the bedroom. We spend at least 8 hours a night in there. If we can control the environment to decrease the inhalant allergens in the bedroom, then if we've got Fluffy out in the living room in the rest of the house, as long as we don't stuff our face down in Fluffy's fur and we remember after petting Fluffy to wash our hands, we may be able to get away with it. It's also peculiar that someone can be living with a companion animal of their own and have no problems, but if they go to visit Aunt Susie with a different companion animal, they may develop acute symptoms.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for the call. Good questions. I'll ask a quick follow-up, and then we'll get on to another listener who's been patiently waiting. Had the experience recently. I have a son who's 4 and a half who early in his life he experienced some asthma symptoms, has not for some time. But we were looking at, went to an open house at a house, looking, you know, doing a little house hunting a little while ago, and walked into one house, which we liked the way it looked, and he started sneezing. And we spent probably half an hour in this house, and he continued to sneeze on a pretty regular basis throughout walking around this house. And that sort of just, you know, made me worry a little bit. And as soon as we left, his sneezing attack went away.
There's lots of things you could think about. Sometimes jute or other synthetic fiber linings of wall-to-wall carpets, molds. There's a lot of possible inhalants. Also plastics, paints, polymers, fumes, depending on how recently it was controlled. One of the points you bring up that's very important for everyone to understand is once you have asthma, it never goes away. You don't grow out of it. You may go forever or a very long time without symptoms. But if the right circumstances occur at the wrong time, you can redevelop symptoms instantly. So you can be asymptomatic for a very, very long time, which is why many people seem to feel they grow out of asthma. But they always have that predisposition that makes them a little bit more sensitive than somebody who never had that experience.
Well, very good. Let's go on next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. This is Brian Metcalf. I'm the environmental associate for the Illinois Public Interest Research Group.
Okay.
And we're a statewide public interest organization. So I was calling because I heard you mention that asthma has been linked to air pollution.
Yes.
Especially from cars and industry. And I was just curious as to how familiar you are with the air pollution that is associated with coal-fired power plants in Illinois. Because I know that it's a serious problem for the Chicago metro area, but it's also a serious problem for the rest of the state. And we actually have research that shows that 33,000 asthma attacks in Illinois are caused by coal-fired power plants every single year. And that includes 1,140 in Peoria, 952 in Davenport, 773 in Springfield. In Rockford, there's 807. In Champaign-Urbana, there's 585. Bloomington Normal, 437.
I think we take your point.
Right. So I just wanted to point out that this is a problem that's, you know, it's not solely limited to the Chicago area.
Oh, yes, you're absolutely correct, sir. There are so many determinants of things that affect air quality. And I think you're absolutely correct. I simply mentioned the first two that came to mind, but you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, I just wanted to call and mention this because it's right now the governor is deciding whether or not to clean up these coal-fired power plants. So for people and listeners who are interested in this and maybe suffering for asthma or whose children may be suffering for asthma, one simple thing that they can do is to simply call the governor and urge
him. Your legislator.
Yes, call your legislator, call your state representative, call Governor Ryan, urge him to clean up these coal-fired power plants. Our research shows that two-thirds of these health effects, these asthma attacks, would be eliminated simply by mandating these power plants meet modern pollution standards. So it's a very simple thing we can do to deal with something that's very serious. Asthma is a very serious situation, so I just wanted to call and put that in.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Not to be a contrary person here, but I think there's also, isn't there good research showing that the particulate content of the air over the past, say, 20, 30 years, as you know, the Clean Air Act and various other measures have gone into effect, perhaps air quality is in some ways, in some measures, improved in recent years.
Yes, this is true. We still have an awful lot of problems with air quality.
Yeah.
But then again, our immune systems have become hyper-responsive. We've become a more obese, sedentary lifestyle. As our first caller mentioned, kids are spending their time in front of TV and computer instead of exercising, which does help improve lung capacity. So it's really a multifactorial thing. And again, I think one of the critical things is, number one, first of all, if you suspect someone may have asthma or asthma-like symptoms, to try and pin down a diagnosis, intervene early. Also, if you're a known asthma patient, there are many, many triggers for asthma, hundreds of thousands, but for most people, the commonest ones are viral respiratory tract infections, secondhand cigarette smoke, and to some extent exercise. And we know for exercise, we're able to pre-treat with certain medications to help prevent symptoms. Mm-hmm. For anyone who has asthma or a predisposition to asthma, if they know for themselves that if they get a cold, their asthma is going to go down the tubes, one of the most protective, best things they can do is when they first get a cold, contact their clinician, say, you know, this is it, my asthma is doing X, Y, and Z, my peak flows are this, and often intervening a bit more aggressively early in that course will prevent a person from a protracted bunch of symptoms with their asthma.
Very good. Well, we're almost at our midpoint. Let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Shauna Johnston. She's a doctor at the McKinley Health Center and a clinical assistant professor of family medicine at the University of Illinois, director of the asthma clinic at McKinley Health Center at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about asthma. Your questions are welcome. Around Champaign-Urbana, you can call us at 333-9455 and toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We had a caller from Aurora a little earlier, I guess, has a follow-up. We'll see what she has. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say something that I did forget about secondhand smoke. The people around a smoker are at their mercy, especially if they're children.
Absolutely. Absolutely and unequivocally.
And you say pollution in general, and I understand what you're saying.
There is a
house and in a car, the child can't get out of the car. And
there is a definite risk of increased asthma in children of people that smoke. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to return to this hygiene hypothesis for a bit and ask you to talk a little bit more. What are we describing here? We're talking about, obviously, antibiotics have been, you know, a lot of criticism. We've been prescribing too many antibiotics. You mentioned that, 90% of what people may experience as a cold is really a virus, and there's no reason to prescribe antibiotics in those circumstances. But you also mentioned the antibiotic hand soaps and the detergents and the various other household products we are using that now have this antibacterial component.
Yeah.
Is there some good research to show that this might be affecting our health?
Well, these are thoughts that are being promulgated worldwide. I think the original research was in England mm-hmm. with this theory, and then a lot of people seem to think, well, that's kind of flaky. Mm-hmm. But it's been gaining more and more credence amongst the respiratory community in the last year and a half. We do know that our immune system has to do something. It has to work to remain strong. Mm. And if we normally carry bacteria in our environment on and in our bodies, but they're not usually pathological unless something breaks down. Mm-hmm. For instance, we have normal bacteria on our skin, usually staph, strep, and they don't really bother us unless we get, say, a bad skinned knee or cut, and they get under the skin, they breach the body's defenses. Mm-hmm. And so if you have small amounts of impurities or bacteria in your environment, we tend to think it gives your immune system something real to do, to make antibodies, to be vigilant to things that are coming from the outside. Now, one of the big problems with overuse of antibiotics, which is a very real concern, There are many factors that involve this. Number one, we as docs and medical community are responsible for the knee-jerk reaction of giving antibiotics in the past because we weren't as well able many years ago to discriminate. So we just wanted to cover with antibiotic just to make sure. Now we know a lot more about diagnosing. We know a lot more what is viral, what is not. We have better indications. But it has taught our whole patient population to a certain extent to, when they're sick, to expect an antibiotic, that an antibiotic will magically help. And I think a lot of the feeling and why people so strongly want antibiotics is, for instance, most people are working these days. Most are two work families. Mm-hmm. it's hard to take off time to go to the docs. It's hard to afford many of the medications. And to decrease the amount of downtime and sick leave from work, we hope that an antibiotic is going to fix it quicker than our body's immune system. This may not always be valid. Some docs seem to feel that patients come in demanding antibiotics. Now, at the university, I've been fortunate enough to note in the last year and a half that our students are a lot more intelligent and know these things and are not quite as demanding. I've had a couple people who really do, and after taking time to explain why an antibiotic is not indicated, will often capitulate, indicating that I am prescribing it only because of their request and not because it is clinically indicated. Or what many of us are doing these days is giving in-case prescriptions, where we'll say, you know, a person will come and say, I have a sinus infection. I need an antibiotic. X always works. And we'll say, well, and we'll check them over. We'll listen carefully and check them over and say, well, you know, I really think right now what you have is viral. It seems like a cold right now. I'm aware of your history that you've needed antibiotics in the past, but I really can't think that you need them right now. But let's give it about 72 hours. Let me give you a prescription for an antibiotic. And if 72 hours you're worse or no better, get it filled and take it till it's gone. And a lot of patients are, I say, now, this one you take today for your symptoms, this one you fold up and put in your wallet. And it's amazing how many, and then I also put a time date, do not fill after 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And many people are just satisfied just to have that kind of as a talisman, that they know that they can get it filled. Mm-hmm. And they're more willing to let their body's defenses and immune system handle immediately what's going on.
What we're talking about, just to put a fine point on it also, and we have another call we'll get right to, it was not known in the early days of antibiotics that bacteria would develop resistance.
Correct.
To antibiotics, and this has become a growing problem. So it's, you know,
it's very scary.
Yeah. So there is a public health concern as well as a personal health issue.
Very much. One of the big problems is it really takes time for us to educate people on why an antibiotic is not needed. And with third-party payers and HMOs crunching down on docs' time so that the average office call is 7.5 minutes, which in my opinion is hardly enough time to even take a decent history, it's often simpler to reach for the prescription pad than educate, but the education is critical.
Very good. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll get next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. This is a very interesting topic. Let me ask you this. I understand that pollution, ambient pollution in the cities, may be a factor with the increase in asthma. Have there been studies to show whether or not, in terms of racial demographics, for example, African Americans or black have a higher incidence of asthma, especially if they live in the inner cities?
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely correct. African Americans, Mexican or Hispanic Americans, and often people, international students from Southeast Asia. We see a lot of multicultural people at university, but we know that specifically Hispanics and African Americans have much more severe asthma, a much greater incidence of asthma, a greater incidence of asthma mortality. Some of these factors are linked to pollution in Center City. Some of these factors are due to things like cockroach allergens in the Center City. One of the biggest ones is probably the lack of access to medical care,
right,
especially ongoing medical care, well health visits, maintenance visits, so that often someone with severe asthma will pop up in an emergency room in crisis and perhaps even be near death, whereas they go from crisis to crisis without ever having continued management. You're absolutely correct.
I just ran across an article off the internet which was alarming to me. I am African American.
Yes.
I have had members of my family as well as close friends who have been afflicted with asthma. And it says African Americans are not getting optimal treatment or information about their asthma compared with white patients with the respiratory ailment, according to the results of a study conducted by Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
Well,
the drug that they're not getting compared to whites is corticosteroids.
Corticosteroids, it, I think, is the basis of treatment for asthma on many respects. Let me try and answer your first, first part of your question. It's my opinion, because I deal with aggressive asthma diagnosis, management, and treatment, and especially education. It is my opinion that in the general community as a whole, not only here in Champaign-Urbana, but in the general community, there is a tremendous lack of education. And I think African Americans are affected. I think other ethnic groups are affected. But because African Americans can have more sudden, more severe asthma, I think it's even more difficult for them. With the appropriate management tools, appropriate understanding of what's going on, appropriate medications, and especially learning about the person themselves, understanding themselves better, it's going to help the person manage their own asthma where the clinician helps troubleshoot. Now, we know now that there's that asthma is caused from inflammation. We used to think that asthma was just tight bronchial muscles causing tightness of the airways. And that's only a secondary response. We now know that the critical factor is airway swelling, phlegm, mucus production produced by a whole bunch of inflammatory chemicals that are released that cause this swelling and narrowing of the airways. And then secondarily, the smooth muscles, and this is something that just came out in a study about a month ago, is the smooth muscle itself actually elaborates inflammatory chemicals, which is something we didn't know. Now, things like Ventolin, albuterol, tend to relax smooth muscle, so they're good symptom relievers, but they do nothing for the airways swelling and inflammation. The safest thing that we can give to someone is inhaled corticosteroids, because at usual doses, there is no systemic absorption, and they protect the airways, they decrease swelling and inflammation. And often used regularly, these inhaled corticosteroids can keep a person asymptomatic for a very long time. What's very frightening is that people that use their inhaled corticosteroids intermittently or when they feel they need it are at a tenfold increased risk of death. And this is a concern also because there are several different kinds of inhaled corticosteroids. Fluticasone or Flovent takes about 3 to 5 days to kick in. Older ones like Asmacort, Beclavent take up to 2 weeks. So you can see if you just start to feel you need it and you're using one of these older ones, it's going to take 2 weeks before it has any effect. Then in somebody who's got a really bad asthma flare, is very, very sick, our ultimate asthma medication is prednisone. It is life-saving. It has side effects when used for high doses for long periods of time, can be given very safely at high dose for short periods of time, and is often the only thing that will rescue a person back from a crisis. One of the neat things is that it's been shown that oral prednisone given in the office or the emergency room is as effective as intravenous corticosteroids in preventing unscheduled revisit or readmission within the next 24 hours. So often if I see somebody in my office who's really sick, I may give them 60 milligrams of prednisone, and I know in 5 hours they're going to be doing a lot better.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, doctor.
Well, you're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. Our lines are all full, so let's go on and talk with some more callers. We'll go next to listener in Terre Haute on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. Back to the emissions from power plants. My understanding from literature I've read in the past, it's been a few years back, so it might have changed, but the pollutant from power plants that triggers asthma attacks is sulfur dioxide and not particulates.
I think both are a factor. With particulates, it's an actual physical irritant. With sulfur dioxide, it complexes with the water in the air to make sulfuric acid, and that's surely not good for your respiratory tract.
Right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Next up, listener in Southeast Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello? Is there a caller there? I guess not. We may have had them wait too long. All right, listener Champagne on line number three. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. Now, I haven't heard the whole show, so maybe you covered this, but it's in response to what you're just saying about antibiotics. The real big problem now with antibiotics is not doctor overuse, because they've become educated on the issue, but it's really coming from the livestock industry that feeds antibiotics en masse to animals, because they've discovered that they can actually... they'll put on weight faster.
Yes.
They're not doing it to keep them from getting infected. They're doing it just because they can get it to market a little quicker. And, you know, at the rate they're going, there is what's going to, you know, use up all the useful antibiotics.
So it's another big factor. It's definitely another big factor.
So, I mean, I think, you know, the we need to put pressure on the agribusiness to stop doing this. I don't know if they need legislation or, you know, to stop it, but it is really, that's a much bigger threat than overuse by the doctors.
Well, I think all of these things we've been discussing this morning combine in all their multiple factors to pose a big threat to us as people. And one of the big things that drives our market economy, of course, is money. And it's very hard sometimes to have industry listen to health concerns when there's a great deal of money at risk.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Just a quick observation, then we'll get on to our next listener. It seems that all the things we're talking about, whether it be antibiotic use in patients or in livestock, chemicals in our environment via air pollution or the household cleaners we bring in, you know, or the medications that we use to address the effects of all these other things. Essentially, what we're dealing with is a great deal of technology and chemical use. And maybe it's no surprise that that has some side effects.
Whenever dealing with anything with medicine, we've got to weigh benefit versus side effect.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of exciting developments happening out there with medications for asthma. One of the things our listeners do need to know about is the metered dose inhalers we've been using forever, with the exception of Proventil HFA, which was put out about 7 years ago. All have CFC, chlorofluorocarbon propellants. Now, the Montreal Accords banned CFC propellants about 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
but they gave the drug manufacturers 3 years to come up with alternate delivery systems. So the drug companies have now gone to HFA or hydrofluoroalkane as a propellant in the traditional metered dose inhalers, and other drug companies have gone to what are called dry powder inhalers, which I think are probably one of the neatest developments that are around, because they are breath actuated and there is not as much coordination involved. Studies have been done comparing inhaled medication delivery systems. And there was one study done in England where an entire asthma population was run through pulmonologist practice. They were given instruction in the proper use of a metered dose inhaler by a respiratory therapist. And there's about 12 steps to use a metered dose inhaler correctly. Similarly, another group was taught how to use the discus form of dry powdered inhaler. All people were checked 2 weeks later. 33% of adults and 27% of children could remember how to properly use a metered dose inhaler. 98% of people could remember how to use the discus device. Some of the commonest failures in using a metered dose inhaler were forgetting to take the cap off, forgetting to shake it, forgetting to hold your breath for 10 seconds, and forgetting to wait a minute before you take the next inhalation. The dry powdered inhalers are exciting. There's been one called Cerevent, a long-acting drug like Ventolin for maintenance. It's been out for about 4 years. And just this April was released something called the Advair Discus, and this is really exciting. It is only for people who are maintained on the long-acting beta agonist Cerevent and inhaled corticosteroid as daily medications and who are stable on these daily medications. Conventional therapy has you taking two breaths of two inhalers twice a day with a spacer. with this new drug, Advair, in the discus. Both drugs are combined in the dry powdered inhaler. Studies have shown that comparing the drugs separately at the same dose to together, that there is a synergistic effect of both drugs in the same device, causing much greater improvement. And what's exciting is instead of doing those two breaths twice a day with a spacer, you have one breath twice a day, no spacer, no fiddling, with an automatic dose counter in the device, and it's just really exciting.
That's great. Well, we have just about 8 minutes left with Shauna Johnston. She is a physician and director of the asthma clinic at the McKinley Health Center at the University of Illinois campus. We have a couple of callers waiting and perhaps time for others. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Rantoul next on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to make a suggestion. We've talked a lot about all the various exposures that are causing this. Maybe we're not only just seeing asthma, but we're seeing reactive airway disease. And again, this is from the combined chemical, biological, all the exposures that we're having from industry, households, education, every place that you look. Now, when we go to the medications, obviously, as you just talked about, you can use Cerevent, you can use prednisone or Preventolin, some of these other ones. However, they may be masking the symptoms. And the question I have along with this, how dangerous is this to continue with medications that maybe mask the symptoms but are not really addressing the problem, where normally in an asthma we're having a constriction of the bronchial airways, but what we're seeing not so much as a constriction where we're seeing a reactive airway disease type of problem?
Well, first of all, to comment, reactive airway disease is another way of saying asthma. Asthma is what we commonly talk about, but for instance, in post-viral infections, anything that causes airways swelling, inflammation, mucus destruction, production can be rightly termed, as you said, reactive airway disease. It's probably a more specific description than asthma. Now, what is critical in causing asthma deaths is people using their short-acting beta agonist, their albuterol, their Maxair, their Ventolin, Proventil, in spite of progressing, increasing respiratory problems and continuing to use this rescue inhaler. We know that people who are on maintenance medications of inhaled corticosteroids and or long-acting beta agonist are much safer and have a tenfold smaller risk of death, so that using inhaled corticosteroids, for instance, on a long-term daily maintenance basis is actually protective to the airways and means that if a person does get a cold, for instance, their reactive airways may cause them less of a severe illness than if they had not been using them. The very critical point, which you rightly bring up, is that increasing use under perception. Now, many asthma patients have breathed so crummily so long, and their management has been so suboptimal that they don't know what it's like when they're breathing good. So consequently, when they perceive that their breathing is bad, it's really bad. But continuing to use a rescue inhaler for symptoms only is a good way to get very sick very fast and sometimes die.
I think, again, that just goes to emphasize that these individuals definitely need it under proper medical care at all times.
Absolutely.
Well, great. Thanks. This is an excellent program.
Well, thanks very much for the call. Before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we cover some of the basics because, I think you've done a great job talking about a number of things related to asthma. But it seems to me that I think it's probably very likely there are a lot of people who don't realize that they have a problem. And maybe we could talk a bit about, how common that is and what people ought to know in terms of the symptoms so that, they can make good decisions as
sure.
Healthcare consumers.
Sure. Well, I think first of all, if you yourself have allergies or hay fever, if you have a first degree relative such as a mother, father, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, who has an atopic or allergic or asthma diagnosis or history, this gives you a known genetic predisposition. So you've got the right susceptibility. Then what matters is what triggers there are in environment. Environmental triggers are often additive. such that say a person who has a predisposition for asthma may do okay. They may get a lot of drippy eyes, itchy nose, runny nose during ragweed season, and they may get along kind of okay during ragweed season. But then if we get them ragweed season and they go to visit relatives who smoke and they pick up a viral respiratory tract infection on top of that, that may just be more than their body's going to deal with. So things to be concerned about may be a chronic cough, shortness of breath. Wheezing can be a concern, but as one of our famous doctors in the past, it may have been Dr. Osler, all that wheezes is not asthma. Wheezing can come from cardiac disease. It is one thing that may make one think about asthma, but you can't make a diagnosis just from wheezing. And in fact, one of the scariest things that happens is when a person's airways are so constricted and they're having such shortness of breath, often their chest will be silent. And I'll give them a breathing treatment, and I'll actually be happy when I start hearing noise because I know at least they're moving air. Now, all of us can have these kind of symptoms with an acute respiratory tract infection or with allergies. What would make one think more of asthma, is this a recurrent pattern? Does this happen during certain situations, certain repetitive environment, time of year? I have a lot of students who come from Chicago and say, well, gee, I never had asthma / allergies till I came to U of I here. And so that's a factor. Also, often people can get nocturnal asthma symptoms. If you're waking in the night because of cough or short of breath, this is a concern. We also know another factor contributing to asthma these days is gastroesophageal reflux disease. So this is often an explanation for external symptoms. My feeling is if you've got a suspicion that you have airway problems, shortness of breath, cough, wheeze, to talk it over with your clinician, express your concerns. Now, asthma is not generally a diagnosis we make at the first visit. We need to follow a person over time. And if symptoms don't resolve, there are basically two kinds of asthma. There's intermittent asthma, which is what we usually call exercise-induced asthma. These people do just fine using a rescue inhaler occasionally. Then there are mild, moderate, and severe persistent asthma patients who all ought to be on inhaled corticosteroids at various dosages. And asthma control in the year 2001 is defined as needing your rescue inhaler twice a week or less. If you're needing your rescue inhaler more than twice a week, your asthma is not in good control and you need to talk to your clinician.
And in that case, you would want to make sure that you're getting more aggressive treatment.
Well, that's my opinion.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of prednisone phobia in the general population and amongst many of my colleagues still. There's the time crunch that I think precludes a lot of them from doing education. Although many local programs, for instance, Carl and I believe possibly Christy, may have asthma education programs available. In my opinion, it can't beat the one-on-one between a clinician, their patient, a patient's family, and a good nurse or other educator that helps with this. One of the things that's critical, I think, in asthma care is as a clinician, you've got to be interested in it. You've got to be involved. And for myself, I'm excited about it. I know that with proper education and stuff, that my patient can have a much better quality of life. And we've done research at this U of I showing tremendously improved quality of life with aggressive education and management. And it's a real high for me to have someone who's sick come in like 6 months later and say, my asthma's never been under such good control. And my mom, who has asthma, I've taken all my handouts and my peak flow meter and everything else that you've told me, and I've taken it home to my mom, and she's going to talk to her doctor too.
Well, that's a good note to end on, and we're here at the end of our time, so we'll have to do that. Our guest has been Shauna Johnston. She is a clinical professor of family medicine at the University of Illinois and director of the Asthma Clinic at the McKinley Health Center. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks so much. It's been great.